Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome back to episode, I can't remember, of this season of Wild Wild Podcast. I know we must be up to like episode 8 or 9 because I threw in a couple of bonus ones that have confused the counting. This is film number 8, however. I know that much.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Adrian. Welcome. If you're listening for the first time, then thank you for coming along. If you're back for more, then you know why, but also thank you. And I am of course joined as ever by my loyal and patient co-host Rod Barnett. Hello, Rod.
Hello, Adrian. How have you been doing?
Well, yeah, all good. And of course, you and I, after talking about it on at least the last two episodes, finally recorded our long-awaited commentary track for another Italian classic.
Mm-hmm.
But we still can't say what it is. So
I know we've still not been given the go-ahead to speak about it. Yes,
but I'm fairly confident it's going to be announced in about a month, and I think people will be excited.
Well, let's get people excited and tell them one little detail that I think we can get away with.
Okay. Yeah,
it is an Italian Gothic. There's that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I mean that narrows it down. It's certainly to
roughly 100 films.
Yeah. It's certainly one that, you know, we've been crying out to be to be restored, so it's very exciting. But yeah, so that's the only other sort of brief bit of news that I had. It's not even that personal, but I just wanted to mention how exciting it is that Radiance Films, a new label here in the UK, who I did an interview. It's the guy that runs Radiance. He used to work for Arrow, and he's now got his own label. And I interviewed him for Cinema Retro a couple of months ago. But just recently, they announced a full restoration and lovely edition of The Horrible Dr. Hitchcock. I can't even speak. The Horrible Dr. Hitchcock, which, again, another gothic Italian film that's been waiting for a restoration for forever.
True.
I'm going to assume you're a fan of that one.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There have been previous releases of it, but none of them have been satisfactory in that apparently each version I'm aware of has been compromised in some way or another. So this new version is very exciting.
Yeah, it's going to have three different versions of the film all in one release, and new essays and commentaries and all that good stuff. So, yeah. Really excited for that. I have to confess, as so often on this podcast, I've never actually seen The Horrible Dr. Hitchcock.
Oh, wow, really?
No, well, it's like one of those films I've read a lot about, but then I've heard that there's not really a very decent version. So I always think, well, there will be eventually. And hey-ho, here there is. So it means I get to watch it for the first time on this new restoration, Blu-ray premiere. So
I wonder if I consider myself lucky or unlucky to have, you know, to have watched it way back when I had no idea that whatever version I was watching was not, you know, the uncut or the one with the proper editing or whatever. I just, you know, stumbled headfirst into it like I did with so many other films at the times.
Yeah, because there's a version, there's an export version, which is 87 minutes long. There is an American version, which is 76 minutes long. And there is also an English dub of the Italian cut with a different title. So, yeah, really intrigued. Yeah, it's not out till October, but I'm pretty pretty thrilled that that is one of the big titles, a bit like the one that you and I have just been involved with. But this is another big one that you know has needed to be done by somebody for years. So anyway, that's about the only bit of news I could think of to share in this episode. Is there anything that you've been doing recently that you can tell us about or want to talk about?
Oh, I've just been concentrating on getting the various podcasts back on track. I've been trapped in the cycle of prepping and getting ready for different commentary tracks, and so it's one of those things that tends to slow down the podcast production. And but back on track, but. Newest episode of The Bloody Pit will be out soon, focusing on a film that many people will wonder why in the world we're covering, King of Kong Island. It's a very strange film, like 20% Jungle Girl, 20% Mad Scientist, 20% Jungle Mercenary, and 20% I don't know, family melodrama. It's a bizarre film. It doesn't make any sense.
That adds up to 100% a film that Rod likes.
Well, I will say I was much more entertained by it than I thought I would be. It's one of those that I had avoided for years, mainly because I didn't know there was a Jungle Girl in it. And long story short, I'll tell you this: if you took the Jungle Girl out, it'd be the same movie. So anyway.
And speaking of Jungle Girls, of course, we've decided that's what we're going to do next. Once we get this episode and the next two films done, we're going to have a Jungle Girl mini season. So that's definitely something to look forward to. And you know, whether or not you've seen those or are fans of those, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen at least one kind of Jungle Girl film. Over the years, there are so many of them, but we'll do our best to pick out some interesting ones. So, yeah, that's coming up. But let's get on to today's film, which has a couple of titles. But the title that we are probably the most familiar with it is, of course, if you look at the IMDb, it's very confusing. So it's released on Blu-ray under this title. He says, looking at the box to check. It's released on the Blu-ray under the name Warriors of the Year 2072.
Yeah.
Cue the Riz Ortolani theme. Is really great, by the way.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I was a little surprised to realize that it was Riz Ortolani, because I'm so used to the stuff that he produced for other genres in the 60s and 70s. But of course, you know, being a musician, he moved with the times. And this is exactly the kind of score that I would expect from a film from this period. And it's insanely memorable. It sticks in your head.
It's pretty funky stuff. I'm going to persuade my son at some point to take a sample and make something out of it. So maybe I'll get him to do that in time for when I edit this episode. But yeah, the music is great. And if you get the Blu-ray from Severin, it comes with a CD.
Mm-hmm,
so you get the whole score, which is pretty nice. But so I mentioned, so it's released on Blu-ray under the title Warriors of the Year 2072, which is the one of the many titles. You may also have seen this film if you're in the UK and you're of the right age to have been renting videos in the 80s. Then it was released by Medusa in 1983 under the name Rome 2033, The Fighter Centurions, which I believe Rome 2023 or Gladiators of 2023 was the working title anyway. But it's also known as The New Gladiators.
Yeah, that's the title I originally saw it under.
Right.
Yeah,
there's also Rome 2033 just on its own. It's kind of an interesting, but interesting that they would have two completely different years. Now, one of the theories that I have heard is that although originally it was 2033, which would have made the fact that some of their technology, like their motorbikes, you know, look pretty much like they're from the 80s. So 2033, having it closer to the time they were making the movie would have been perhaps slightly more believable. But the theory is that the Colosseum in Rome was built in AD 72.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that somehow this film was about celebrating the 2000th anniversary of the Colosseum, which of course never gets mentioned anyway in the film.
I know.
So I'm not sure, but maybe that's the reason why the year was changed for some of the versions of the title. But who can say? Because I don't think there's actually a year even on the screen at any point.
No, not that I remember at all, no.
You're going purely off the title. Is this a film that you had some experience with going back?
Yes, I don't know how, but I saw this sometime in the 80s. My vague memories of it, before catching back up with it on bootleg in the 90s, was that I somehow saw this on video or on television or something. I wish I could remember exactly how, but I know I caught it because it stuck in my mind because of a number of the visuals, which, and of course, isn't that much of a shock, which puts this in the possible category of first Fulci film I ever saw without knowing what I was looking at, of course.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I can't be clear because the memories are so fuzzy. But the reason that I was probably drawn to watch this is because of the main actor, the actor who plays Drake, Jared Martin,
I wasn't that familiar with him, although he's got a kind of recognizable face. But looking at his credits, he was an American TV guy, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. His face was a regular sighting on network television throughout the 70s. Which is how I was aware of him, because at the time that I'm pretty sure I saw this initially in my youth, I was familiar with him because of a much missed and lamented short television series that he was a part of called The Fantastic Journey. It aired in 1977, was short-lived, it was a mid-season replacement. There were only about 13 episodes of it produced, and it became a fascination for me and probably most kids of my age. I was 9 when it aired on television. I was 9 years old, and so it stuck in my mind. And it's one of those things that, for years, not understanding how these things work, I just assumed surely this, you know, there were more episodes of The Fantastic Journey out there, and that one day the show would return to the television so I could finish watching more and more of this incredible television show that, of course, when I went back to watch it, it's still kind of interesting, but, you know, when you're 9 years old, incredible television series are not exactly the same as when you're, in your 20s or 30s.
Yeah.
But from that and just dozens of other television shows.
Oh, yeah. All the big ones, Fantasy Island, Incredible Hulk, $6 Million Man, Charlie's Angels, like he's got a Knight Rider, Airwolf. Like he was just in all the cool shows, Magnum PI,
Love Boat,
loads of stuff. Yeah,
we're getting pretty broad there with the definition of cool. But yes,
he did come back to Fulci a few years later.
Yeah, for Enigma.
Yeah, which is interesting. So obviously, considering Fulci's reputation, they must have got on a bit for him to consider coming back.
I guess so. He was also well known because he was in like more than 30 episodes of Dallas, which was of course a massive hit. And he's one of those faces that I just I always just assumed. And this is me not knowing anything in my youth about how these things worked. You know, my thing was I just assumed that Gerard Martin was also in like a zillion other things that I'd just not seen. And then the fact that, you know, decades later I look back and go, wait a minute, where did he go? And then to learn that he still had a vibrant career, just wasn't as visible as I assumed it to be. But that's the thing. He was what probably drew me to watching it on video in my teenage years. But, you know, the memories don't stick as hard as a lot of other things have.
And he, just about 5 years ago, he directed a film starring Treat Williams. So he's still active. But
he did, I think, Mr. Martin, unfortunately, did pass away in 2017.
Oh, I see.
Pancreatic cancer got him. He was 75, so yeah.
One of the last things he did then.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, but as we're on it, why don't we... I mean, we've talked about Fulci before, haven't we? Well, yes, we have. I mean, he was on a very early episode of the podcast when we talked about our favorite Southern Italian comedy duo, Franco and Ciccio.
Oh, yeah.
So we've probably talked quite a lot about Fulci before. But, yeah, some other names in the cast worth mentioning, of course, is Fred Williamson.
Yes.
Who seemed to just love the post-apocalypse genre. He's in so many of these films.
He was in at least, like, four, maybe five.
And, obviously, we talked about him with the Bronx Warriors. But was there anyone else in the cast that you wanted to mention? We've got a couple of other returning guests in Al Cliver and Hal Yamanucci as Akira, which again he gets to do some cool stuff, a bit more karate, and then sadly gets killed off.
Al Cliver, you have to mention he has a nice role in the film, and as is always true, spoiler alert, Al Cliver never makes it to the final credits. No. So,
did you watch? There's a really interesting interview with him on the Blu-ray. Where, I mean, he's still around, which is good to know. And they clearly shot it during lockdown because the interview's done out on the street outside his house.
Mm-hmm.
But he appears to have completely lost his voice now.
I don't know. I don't know exactly why that is. Yeah. He's still the gregarious guy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was really interesting, really funny. But, yeah, the whole interview was done in a whisper, which is sad. But, yeah, it was interesting just to... You know, good to know that he's still going. Other people that are also returning, we've got Claudio Casanelli, one of my favorites. I love him in his Poliziotteschi films especially, but he's obviously just done so much good stuff. Was it Mountain of the Cannibal God, or is it Cannibals of the Mountain God? Island of the Fishman. Yeah, so he's done loads of different genres. I didn't recognize him at first because I'm so used to seeing him in things like Suspicious Death of a Miner, where he's got lighter hair, and then in this film he's like his futuristic dark combed forwards kind of hair, and it was like, that guy looks familiar, and then it took me a little while to figure it out. And I'm guessing this is around the same time he would have been shooting his role as Zeus in Hercules. For Luigi. That was all around this sort of time. Anyone else you wanted to mention? I've got at least one more I want to talk about.
Well, I mean, Donald O'Brien is somebody we probably ought to mention.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Haven't we seen him before?
Oh.
On the podcast? Has he been anything that we've covered? I can't remember.
Surely we've talked about Donald O'Brien before.
Oh, yeah. 2020 Texas Gladiators, of course.
That's right. He was in that.
Yeah,
but he was just people. You know, he's been in so many movies that I've seen over the years repeatedly. So,
I mean, it's fair to say he's unrecognizable in this film.
I know his face is hidden behind a bunch of really rough makeup. Yeah, very, very hidden behind. I mean, you can see it's him if you know what he looks like. But yeah,
yeah. And obviously, he's had a very long and interesting career, going right back to I think probably as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, really interesting role in this film that we'll... I don't want to give too many spoilers, but yeah, he's got quite an interesting role. He's supposed to be like a mechanic, but I don't think we ever see him anywhere near a motorbike. He just kind of talks about how he's got to do some work on Drake's bike, but we never see any of that, which I thought was interesting. But anyway, the other person I wanted to mention was Eleonora Brigliadori, who plays Sarah, and she's got her... You notice how both of the women in this film have very modern bobs. They've both got the same haircut, but one's blonde, one's brunette. But it's like the haircut of the future. And so Sarah's got this blonde of the future bob. Yeah. But she... I don't know how familiar, or whether she looked familiar to you, because I don't think she's been in anything else that either of us are likely to have seen. She's mostly done a lot of Italian television.
No, she didn't ring it. She didn't ring a bell for me at all, I have to admit.
Although just after she made this film, she did a film for Sergio Corbucci, which I think was a kind of Italian sex comedy, called Sono un fenomeno paranormale, which I think means I am a paranormal phenomenon, is how I would read that. But anyway, I was looking her up because I quite liked her performance in this, and I wondered why I hadn't seen her in anything else. And it turns out she's quite an interesting person. So when she made this film, she was in her early 20s, and a couple of years later, she was the cover model for Playmen, the Italian Playboy magazine.
Mm. Okay.
But then in 2007, she was sued because she painted a cliff on the coast of Sardinia, which she claimed she did for artistic purposes, apparently. So she'd painted some kind of mural on the side of a cliff.
Okay.
But then more recently, she's become one of these people who speaks out against science.
Oh,
She's been publicly decrying chemotherapy. And she advocates the Hamer method, which is, there's this German physician who's basically this kind of physician who talks about pseudoscience and claims to be able to cure cancer and all this kind of stuff. And that diseases come from unsolved inner conflict, which there's a little bit of Scientology in that, I think.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, so she's been speaking out against science to do with cures for cancer, basically. And she's been on TV shows in Italy, and she apparently attacked a reporter who was investigating her because of her alternative healing. So this is all within the last 10 years. Seems like she's gone a little bit off the deep end.
It does happen from time to time.
But the fact that she was a Playman model is interesting. In the book that I've been using all through this season, After the World Ends, when post-apocalyptic movies were telling the future, there is a copy of the poster for this film. I think it's the French poster, Les Mercenaires du Futur. And the poster has her lying on the floor, holding a gun, wearing the kind of super futuristic space bikini that I think even Stella Starr in Starcash would say, that's a bit extreme. Like, she's practically naked in this poster, which of course is not in the film at all. She's very professionally dressed for the role that she plays in this movie. But on the poster, they've just got her as the sex appeal at the front, almost entirely nude, except for a couple of stripes. It's a little bit like she's wearing, what's his name now? It's gone out of my head. Sacha Baron Cohen. Oh, Borat. You know Borat?
Oh, yeah, the famous hysterical Borat's swimsuit. Yeah,
Borat's green mankini. It's like she's borrowed that off him, basically. And it's not... So that's quite funny. Anyway, so that she's on the pod. So she was being used in some of the marketing as the sex appeal for the film. But the film is... there's no sort of sex or nudity in the movie at all. Kind of classic Fulci violence. But perhaps one other name to mention before we get into the plot is one of the writers behind the film, the one who claim to have come up with the story was Dardano Sacchetti, who I think we've talked about him many times before.
Yes, we have.
And there's a great interview with him on the disc as well, which I watched, where he talked about how there was not a lot of love for this film. Like, neither him nor Fulci were that bothered, I think, is what he said. They were not that fussed. But originally,
and you know what? That's okay, because I have enough love for it for both of them.
Yeah, exactly. So. Gets away with it. So he wrote it originally as a satire on advertising and how people were killing each other in sort of gladiatorial games that were all sponsored and things. Now, he talked about this in the interview like he'd had this really original idea to do this. And at the back of my mind, I was thinking, did he ever see The Tenth Victim for a start?
Yes.
Which did that exact same thing. But then also the obvious one is Rollerball, which this film owes a great debt to.
Oh, massive, massive debt to Rollerball.
Right
down to the casting of Gerard Martin, who looks a lot like James Caan, let's be clear.
That is absolutely, yes. That's it, yes. I was thinking it was familiar, but yeah, you're right. So he seemed to be claiming to... I think his main claim was to be able to do all that with gladiators, I guess. So maybe that was the original angle he was going for. But because that was going to... What he wrote was too expensive. He said that I don't know whose idea it was, Fulci's idea possibly, although there are other names attached, including Elisa Briganti and Cesare Frugoni.
Well, remember, Elisa Briganti was his wife, so...
Oh, that's true, yes. Somebody had the idea to make it a giallo, so he talked about how there were giallo elements brought in to the film as well to help fill the running time, but in a kind of cheaper way than some of the more expensive stuff that he'd written. So I think that's why he went off the film and wasn't that bothered in the end, and he felt that Fulci didn't care that much about it either. But so yeah, so you've got this film that's a post-apocalypse film. Stretching the definition of post-apocalyptic, I guess, because I don't think there's actually been an apocalypse. It's just the future.
Yeah, it just seems to be... This is the one that doesn't feel as if it were taking place after some, you know, nuclear holocaust or, you know, massive contamination or horrible disease that, you know, wiped out a lot. This is just, you know, we're however many decades further into the future, and this is how things have progressed.
Yeah.
And so this is how we're going to talk about things in the present day by using the future.
Yeah. So, and there's some really great... They obviously thought it was great themselves, because we get a lot of shots of it. But somebody built this massive model of Rome, where you've got the older buildings like the Colosseum and the Vatican, but wedged or all around are these big high-rise blocks, and they've got little car lights moving along and stuff like that, and like sort of UFO type. But they look like UFOs, but I think they're basically... It's like a kind of bus or something. I don't know.
Yeah, they know. It's either public transportation or individual transportation.
We get some great shots of this cityscape. The camera loves panning across it or tracking along, following the journey of this thing flying over the city. And we get to see that cityscape several times. But it's a fabulous model. And it looks like it was probably a fairly decent size as well.
Yeah, it had to be. I will admit that almost every review you're going to find of this is going to talk about how unconvincing to a large degree those miniatures are. And I'm not going to argue that fact because, yeah, they aren't. But at the same time, they're part of what gives the film a kind of wackadoo charm for me. I just love this attempt to present a Blade Runner-esque visual without the money to really pull it off. So
because they're also that you can see that they're using slide projectors and stuff to project images onto some of the buildings like their big billboards, and you can actually see the slides changing. You know how at old slide carousels, the slide would go out to one side and then the next one would come in the other side.
Oh, I didn't even really think about that. It just always because of that weird the changes of the visuals on those billboards in Blade Runner,
yeah,
always felt like a weird shift as well. It just always seemed like,
yeah,
yeah. I never even thought about how they were accomplishing it and what that would mean. But yeah, because I think these days I'm just so used to those damnable electronic billboards along the highway that.
Mm.
Change, you know, the advertising changes every few seconds as well, and it's just like one image moving to the next. It's just like whatever, another one.
But I'm fairly convinced it's just a slide, which is great. Like they are using, they don't have much money, but they've got imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And talent. I mean, it does look like a model, but we can appreciate that just in the same way that we can appreciate Wild Wild Planet. You know, you're just looking at this great art.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has built this fantastic model, and it must have been heartbreaking when they just had to smash it all up and chuck it in a skip at the end of the film, because it looks like it was so much work.
This is true.
Dardano Sacchetti said that it was a British artist who came and made it for them. I don't know who it was, but. It's really cool. But yeah, shall we talk about the plot?
Yeah, I can't wait because, like I say, this is not typical of the films that we've been covering in this season because this one is kind of just a continuation of modern day Into the Future without an apocalypse, and therefore it kind of doesn't fit, but at the same time, it is really of a piece with all the other things that we've been talking about.
Oh, I nearly forgot. Sorry. Before we get to that, one last amusing side note about Eleonora Brigliadori is that in 1985, she released a single on vinyl called Balla Il Tip Tap.
And,
and the writer of Balla Il Tip Tap was Frank Yankovic, who was the American polka king from Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, Al Yankovic's father.
Well, apparently they're not related because I had to look that up.
Really? Like,
Frank Yankovic. According to the... I mean, it might not be true, but according to the Wikipedia, they're not related.
Oh, my goodness.
But that seems like too much of a coincidence. But yeah, so she's done this Italian pop single written by the Cleveland Polka King. And which...
Much competition for that in Cleveland, isn't there?
I know, yeah. And apparently it was a theme for a TV show, so it might be connected to her TV career. But the B-side is called L'amore è un film, which I think means the love of a film or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can pick that up, should you want, on Discogs for £1.29. So it's clearly not that collectible.
Apparently not.
But anyway, I didn't want to forget that. Balla il tip tap, sotto le stelle c'è la musica, tu immagina lo strie fra, ci riuscirai, balla il tip tap. Guarda tu, sei Ginger accanto a Fred Astaire, vuoi continuare il sogno un poco, eccoti il refrain. C'è un po' di boogie woogie e un po' di break e disco dance, ma sei più chic, balla il tip tap. Anyway, okay, Warriors of the Year 2072. So here is the plot summary according to the book. Rome, 2072. Violence reigns supreme. TV stations compete to offer the cruelest programs. One of those, WBS, aware that spectators always want more, decides to launch a new program based on circus games. Now let's just step back a little bit here, because before we get to that bit, so the film opens with some with us watching some games,
mm-hmm.
Which is basically a load of stunt motorcyclists and Claudio Casanelli, who I think he's playing somebody called Cortez, and I think they've kind of darkened his skin a little bit to make him look like he might be Mexican, but he's called Cortez, and he's like the producer of this TV station, and they've got this show. Where Drake, who is the champion fighter is fighting these other guys, and they're all riding around doing tricks and stuff in this arena. So it's established there that Drake is the star, but the rival network has better ratings. So Cortez is getting annoyed, and he appears to have a boss whose name is, was it Joe?
I can't even remember the boss's name, yeah.
But this boss just appears every so often.
On a screen,
On the screen. And pretty sure his name... Oh, no, Sam. That was it, Sam. He's uncredited. So Sam pops up occasionally and tells him... So Sam says, right, we've got this idea. We're going to create... we're going to bring back the gladiatorial games. So that's what they decide to do. They're going to launch a new program. It's going to be the most violent... an exciting show. It's going to get all the ratings. And they want to have Drake be the star of the show, which for some reason means they have to kill his wife.
Well, now, okay, let's unpack that a little bit here. What we're looking at is a kind of a dystopian future where we have this strange thing called reality television. That it just seems so alien to what we experience here in the early 21st century. I don't understand. And the show, I love this show. It's called Kill Bike. It's as if they had a group meeting and realized that to boil
a 5 year old. Yeah, it's like, what would be a cool show, little Johnny? Kill Bike.
Kill okay. Bike. Yes, where people kill each other on motorcycles. Yay, Kill Bike. But so we have what is supposed to be, I mean, we're in Rome, right? It's supposed to be gladiatorial fights to the death on motorcycles. Now, you know, this is not the first time something like this has been put on film. Hello, George Romero. But at the same time, this is a pretty interesting way to introduce us to an idea of a deadly competitive game on television that can be both extraordinarily exciting and it looked very dangerous and, you know, be something that can hold your attention. It's not unbelievable that a show like this would exist. I mean, like, at all.
I'd watch it. It was cool.
Yeah, yeah. And so what we end up with is this this search for ratings, this, you know, this incessant desire to up the ante on either the violence or just whatever it is that will draw an audience to these things. Yeah. And the one of the problems they're running into, and of course this is, you know, this has reverberations all the way down from Rollerball directly, which is they have this one star who's so good at this game that he really can't seem to lose.
Yeah, and because he's also become, like you said, like a reality star because he just got married he's had his big celebrity wedding to a Hollywood star called, is that Susan, I believe? Played by Valeria Cavalli.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that was
her. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And who some people may recognize from A Blade in the Dark. That's the only thing I recognize her from, anyway. So they have this lovely home that they live in that's full of... it was almost like they live in a greenhouse. It's like this kind of futuristic house that's got thousands of plants in it. And they have this idyllic life together. And then one day... there's a break-in at the house, and it suddenly the film goes a little bit Clockwork Orange, which I thought was an interesting twist.
Yeah,
where these three guys in white suits turn up and basically kill her. And then the film cuts away. Oh, just as Drake comes back, he's sort of outside the house. But then we don't find out what happened next.
No, we're only told after the fact what happened, which is that he stumbled upon these intruders in his house murdering his wife and went berserk and killed them all. But we're unsure of the details until later on.
Yeah. He's got this laser gun just happily, sort of handily lying around in his house, which apparently you can be sentenced to death for killing the men that have just broken into your house and killed your wife.
Which seems a little strange.
He needs a better lawyer.
A much better lawyer.
So then he's thrown into prison, but that it's all an elaborate scheme because there's new gladiatorial games that the gladiators have to be prisoners, apparently.
Well, that's the new show that they've come up with because this incessant search for ratings has caused them to create a new show, which is essentially Kill Bike only with prisoners. And so we can justify the deaths and murders of all of these people because they're in prison for heinous crimes.
So that means they can get Drake to come and be in their show.
Mm-hmm.
And they hope to use to motivate him by the hatred that he has for the men who killed his wife to do all these terrible things and be violent. And
yeah, and so they end up hooking him up to this machine to kind of dredge up the memories of the night of his wife's murder. And I don't know that you necessarily need to do that, guys. I mean, I would still be carrying that anger around for decades.
Yeah.
I mean,
so yeah, this is where we meet Sarah Eleonora Brigliadori. I like saying her name, even though I'm sure I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's quite fun to say. Brigliadori. So this is where we meet her. Yeah, she's the sort of scientist for the TV station who is probing their memories to find out what's going to be the thing that will make them hate the most. Because then they go into this simulator where it's basically a room with a strobe light and things appear in front of them that they will hate and then kill. That's like their training. Is to be in this flashing room. Now, the Blu-ray comes with a warning about epilepsy at the beginning, like seizures could be caused by watching this film. And can you imagine if you'd seen this in the cinema? There's it's like 5 minutes of strobing.
I know. It must have caused somebody a problem at some point.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It's incessant, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't stop for 5 minutes. So he's put into this dome to fight, and these three guys in their white suits pop up. It's very good. Like, it looks amazing. They're popping up and they're kind of smiling and quite sinister and dancing around in front of him. And he's being told by the kind of prison warden called Raven, kill them, shoot them, kill them. And he can't do it. He won't do it. He says he's never fired a gun before. And Sarah also has been probing his memories. And we're starting to realize now that maybe he didn't kill those guys.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, he meets... So hang on, let's go back to the plot summary. I've closed the book. He's thrown into jail with a ragtag mob of degenerates, among whom the amateur of B-movies will easily recognize some famous faces in the genre. Fred Williamson, Howard Ross, Hal Yamanucci, and Al Cliver.
Exactly.
So yeah, he's in with these bunch of criminals, and they all, of course... They don't like him because he's the famous poster boy.
He's the famous pretty boy.
But eventually, after beating him up and he won't fight back, they start to realize that their strength comes from working together rather than against each other.
I like how they lean into the idea that there's a that the core idea is for them to have these people be like a group that don't really cohere into a team. But that, of course, is exactly what our main character, Drake, manages to do, which is to get them to cooperate, to get them to see that they need to cooperate with each other. And, of course, that isn't drawn out as effectively as it might have been, except in just a couple of scenes. But it's enough to give you the idea that the reason that things happen the way they do later in the movie is because of his form of leadership once he's once he's institutionalized with these folks.
And it's basically come into prison and he is now the daddy within about 5 minutes.
Pretty much. He has to go through the standard, you know, jailhouse hazing that goes along with establishing the hierarchy and getting everyone to understand where they fall in it. And I have to say it's pretty effective stuff, but it is also something you've seen in roughly 1,000 prison movies.
Yeah.
So.
So they team up, and I don't want to go into too many spoilers, because if you haven't seen this film, you really should. And there are a few twists and turns.
But yes, there are.
There's an attempted breakout, because Drake's pal, what was his name? Oh, Monk, who his apparently his mechanic, who we never really see fixing anything. And he's a horribly burned face, and he's got like robotic eyes and things like that.
Yeah.
But he gives Drake this magic pill that when he swallows it, he can control technology with his mind.
Oh man, I'd forgotten about that. Oh yeah,
that which only is only really used in one sequence. So maybe, you know, you can swallow that thing, but you can only use it until the next visit to the bathroom, and then you haven't got those powers anymore.
Because once it's out of your system, it's over. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't think that whatever he swallowed dissolves. I think it just goes straight through. But on its way through your digestive system, it gives you telepathic control over electronic doors, apparently. So that's quite fun. So there's an attempted breakout. But of course, as we know, that doesn't work.
Nope.
Because they have to fight in the games. Otherwise, the audience will want their money back.
Well, I do love the middle section of the film is actually pretty darn interesting. It's not as interesting as the last, like, you know, 20 or 25 minutes, but I do like the whole, you know, team coming together or attempting to break, you know, this group of guys attempting to break out of prison, all that stuff where we're shown these characters interacting with each other. I really do enjoy, because there's a lot going on there, and everybody's playing it as well as they can, and there's a lot of really interesting little bits and pieces along the way. I like how at a certain point Drake and all the other prisoners realize that the scumbag Raven, the guy who's kind of in charge of their little prison cell there, there's only so much he can do to them, because he can't really harm them because they have to be in the TV show, and they start using that to get things that they want. And
turn the tables, and yeah, it's really good. But also, of course, we've got this side plot of Sarah realizing that Drake is innocent, and she wants to figure out what's going on and who really killed his wife. And so this is where the kind of giallo element comes in, with the amateur detective. And she goes off to this old church that's slightly futuristic as well on the inside to find her old professor, who apparently invented the computer that is running this whole thing. Because that's one thing we forgot to mention, is there's this program called Junior that is benign, apparently, but is the kind of AI, basically AI gone rogue, that is behind a lot of what is going on, which is funny, because I just obviously went to see the new Mission Impossible, which is also about AI going rogue.
This is true.
I thought that was quite interesting. But so she's off solving that, and there are more murders, and
let's stop for just a moment and think about because this is a movie that has so many different elements within it that it's easy to gloss over. I mean, we can't talk about every single thing in here. This podcast would be about 2.5 hours long, maybe three.
You could leave that for the bloody pit.
Exactly, that's what we do over there. But with this Professor Toman character, the inventor of Junior, the WBS computer system. I love that the way they present this character is he's kind of become a mystic guy. That's why he's hanging out at this church area.
Yeah, and playing the organ.
Yeah, I mean, in the moment he starts talking about his invention's soul, you realize, holy crap, are we going down that road? And luckily, that's just kind of a little alcove that we put one foot in and look around and then back away from. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Although it does kind of right at the end of the film, where we find out the truth about Junior.
Exactly. Which means that even something as wackadoo as that idea is something that is eventually paid off, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got these two competing things, and Sarah, I mean, there's no romantic interest, of course, and apparently, you know, Drake hopefully is still in mourning, but there's the suggestion that the two of them may become something in the future. Because Sarah, so the games start, and I thought these were really well shot. The actual games, it's really cool. They're basically bike and sidecar contraptions. So it's representing the chariot races, where you've got a motorbike and then a sort of cage style sidecar that you stand on. And that does happen for real. I've seen races like people do sidecar racing like that. So that's a real thing. Mm-hmm. And the way that it's shot is actually really good. It's quite exciting. There's a lot of shots.
I think all the action sequences in the film are really fun. There's a lot of really good action sequences, especially in that final half hour.
Yeah, they've obviously got a camera truck, and the bikes are racing very close to it, and the camera is quite low to the ground. So it's pretty dynamic, and there's speed and there's movement, and they're fighting with each other. And yeah, I think it's really cool. But I don't want to say too much more. But I don't want to say too much more about what happens next. But so we've got, obviously, we've got the games. Who's going to win the games? Which of the gang is not going to make it to the end? Is Sarah going to be able to uncover the mystery behind the murders? And Junior, is Cortez a villain? Or is he actually, is it him or not? That's open to, we're not sure. Is Fred Williamson going to make it to the end, as was always in his contract, that he could never be killed off? Something that Al Cliver could have perhaps tried to get a few more times into his contracts.
Yeah,
there's a lot building up to quite a good finale, I think. So I really liked this film. It's really fun. I had seen it before, for a change, but I really enjoyed watching it again. It's really entertaining.
Oh, I absolutely love this film. I really do enjoy this movie. Every time I go back and rewatch this, I have a blast. And
yeah,
almost every element of it, even the ones that would get it the most criticism, are things that I actually do enjoy. And let's, by the way, I think we should probably address one particular thing, which is the Running Man idea.
Mm.
It won't take much thought for anybody to realize that this movie came out in 84, and in 1987 the film The Running Man came out, and it's kind of similar in a lot of different ways. And so one might think that because one movie came after the other movie, that perhaps The Running Man was a ripoff of this film. And that is not necessarily true at all, simply because, well, no. A lot of different ideas often just stayed in different places and therefore have a visual similarity and a plot similarity. But the real fact of the matter is that The Running Man was based on a Stephen King story, a novel that he published under his pseudonym Richard Bachman, that came out like 2 or 3 years before this movie was made. And so The Running Man was based on the Stephen King novel and not this film. Not that it might not have taken some visual cues or some ideas from it, just because once a movie is out in the public, I mean, things do seep into the greater filmmaking consciousness. But The Running Man is not actually a ripoff of this film, except in that it came after and is kind of thematically and, I don't know, plot-wise, similar. But remember, all of these things kind of descend from The Tenth Victim in the first place, from 1965, which was also an adaptation. So,
and obviously, Endgame is also quite similar.
Yeah.
But according to, I don't want to just be one of those podcasts that reads things off Wikipedia, but just having just looked up The Running Man, apparently there was a lawsuit because they said that it had plagiarized a French film called Le Prix du Danger, or The Price of Danger, I guess, from 1983, which was based on a short story from 1958.
Hmm.
And there is also a German TV film from 1970. So it's clearly, like, the idea of this is, it's been around and lots of people have touched on it over the years in various different ways.
Yeah. So calling one a ripoff of the other is probably stretching things. If
We could just enjoy them all. I mean, The Running Man is fantastic. So, and it obviously had a lot more money to spend as well.
I have to admit, though, I do think I like this movie more than I like The Running Man. I have to admit.
Yeah, fair enough. I was looking to see like what kind of release it had had. And so it did get a VHS release, like I said, in the UK. But I couldn't find any reviews of it at the time. But I did find a Variety review. It appears not to have been released, at least I think Variety only reviewed stuff that came out in the cinema. So it appears to have come out in 1988, which is when the review was published. So it's 5 years up. Yeah, 5 years later. So I just thought I'd read it for you because it's not very good. It also talks about it being another forerunner of The Running Man. It calls it a meek sci-fi effort from horror maestro Lucio Fulci. Following inadequate model shots of a futuristic cityscape cribbed from the Blade Runner style, Pick posits two rival international TV networks of the future competing for popular violent programming. One has the hit Kill Bike Show. I want a t-shirt that just says Kill Bike. of which Jared Martin is a top competitor in deadly motorcycle battles. Rival networks decide to create the Battle of the Damned. I also want that on a t-shirt. Now, I think Battle of the Damned would have been a better title as well. What a, for a film, that would have been a great
Idea. Well, I don't know. I always thought that somehow working the word gladiator into a variant title for this would be good too. But
true. Well, I think they did. There was at least one of them.
Oh yeah. Well, definitely. Yes. But
boring film focuses on the preparations and arguments concerning the game, which actually does not begin until 1 hour into the picture. Key plot element of a renegade computer program responsible for the evil game doesn't work. The actual game is modeled after chariot races, with two-man motorbikes used as the modern version. The cast, including the since-deceased Claudio Casanelli, is operating on half power. Fulci's fans are bound to be disappointed. I mean, a bit harsh.
Very harsh, but, in my opinion, yes.
You know, I guess from this reviewer writing this in 1988, when he'd probably seen four other films that day, he's not the kind of audience that they were necessarily going for with this movie. Whereas if I had seen this when I was about 10 years old, it would have been my favorite film of all time.
Oh, well, I'm pretty sure that I saw this sometime in my teenage years, and it stuck in my memory for a long time till I was able to track it down in the 90s on a bootleg to be able to watch it again. So, yeah, you're not far off.
So I think we should probably leave it there, because I don't want to give anything else away, like I said. But is there anything else that you
I think we should take the opportunity really quick to just compare notes on where we think this falls when we start talking about Lucio Fulci, because to me, this is evidence of Fulci still working at a level that just really makes me very happy. This is him still in that phase of, because that's one of the funnier things that Dardando Sacchetti talks about in that interview, about how unloved this film was by the people who made it.
Yeah.
Which is that Fulci was still riding the crest of the success that he had had with his horror movies, starting with Zombie, and had managed to get two contracts at the same time, and was just trying to play one, you know, trying to play the game of seeing which one would actually get in front of the camera first. But to me,
wasn't he planning to shoot them both at the same time?
Like, yeah, he thought he had this idea that somehow he could manage that.
Yeah,
that's never going to work out. But the joy of this is still Fulci on that streak, in my opinion, where he was so his career got completely reinvigorated by the success of Zombie and the Beyond and all this kind of stuff, to the point where we're looking at these movies and realizing, oh man, this is another one during that period, you know, because he made this after House by the Cemetery and New York Ripper, and around Conquest. The same time that he made Conquest and Murder Rock and all these crazy films that I absolutely love. And so to me, this is before his illness kind of changed things for him and made him and made it so that by the late 80s, he's a lesser filmmaker because physically so much had been taken away from him. And for me, my favorite Fulci films are not really the horror movies. I love them to death, and that's what I came to Fulci for. But I'm a huge fan of the thrillers that he made in the 70s to a large degree, and also the kind, you know, like in Murder to the Tune of Seven Black Notes, and also love Don't Torture a Duckling and Lizard in a Woman's Skin, one on top of the other. These are the movies that I think of as some of the best work he ever did, and I do love the horror films as well. But when you start talking about things like the weird ones in his early 80s films, like Conquest and this, I love them too, because it still feels like a filmmaker who's just bursting with energy and enthusiasm and throwing these things on the screen with as much skill and verve as he can manage. I love that whole run, even the ones that I don't think of as the better or fantastic films, like Contraband, which I think is a good film, but it's not one of my favorites. I still look at this whole string of movies and think, wow, this is an Italian director who's luckily being able to really thrive in this period. And it just feels very, very, it feels almost like a perfect synergy between a time when so many things in the film industry were changing, but this man's energy, even as he was getting older, was still running high.
Yeah. No, yes, you've said it all for me. Okay. I agree entirely. Yes, I mean, yeah, he's still going strong at this point, and it's really great to see. There was one thing I did notice that I wanted to mention with this film. Obviously, you know, they're doing the special effects on the budget that they had. But did you notice every time there was an optical process shot? Because quite often they were looking at monitor screens and they can see people talking on the monitor screens, mm-hmm. which is sort of laid on optically. Whenever you got one of those optical process shots, there were like three or four quite big black splodges on the screen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And,
like, they were obviously just in the printer and nobody cleaned it between shots or just noticed, or it was too late when they did it. But every single process shot, it's like there's a fly just on the screen. It's like something suddenly landed on your telly.
Yep.
But it's there every time.
You're right. And, you're right.
That was quite funny to see that. But again, I don't really mind. You know, it's a nice reminder of how they were working under quite difficult conditions, and you know, they're doing what they can. You know. So anyway, right. We want to finish things off here. But I just wanted to mention we've had some listeners contact us, which is always nice. Please do get in touch. So remember last time I played that little game with you looking at different countries and who was listening?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So somebody on Instagram got in touch. So hello to you, Forest Walking. And they said, just listening to the new episode, curious to know how many listeners from Finland. So Forest Walking is from Finland. So that's pretty cool. So I was able to then tell them 71. I couldn't tell how many listeners, but I can tell them downloads. And at this point, when I spoke to them 2 weeks ago, we'd had 71 downloads. So I asked them if that was all them. I don't think we've had 71. They can't be, because we haven't done 71 episodes.
No, we haven't.
So they replied, I'm based in Finland. I'm new to the podcast. I only listened to about 5 episodes. So there must be at least 2 of us here. So I suggested they get together and start a fan club.
Yes, our first fan club, and it will be in Finland.
So this would suggest to me that we have at least 3 listeners in Finland. So hello out there in Finland. Please do get in touch. We'd love to hear where you are, how you found us, what films you like, anything like that. It's really, it's one of the reasons that podcasting is so exciting. And I know you get a lot of feedback on the Bloody Pit from people all over the world, and it is really cool.
It's fun, and it's very, it is the kind of thing that reignites your enthusiasm for doing a show when you do realize that there are people out there that are really engaged.
We had one email I wanted to just quickly read from Tom, who also signs himself Uncle Bella.
Hmm.
And he says, hello, Adrian. Hello, Rod. Just a quick message to say that I always enjoy all of your podcasts. Great subject, theme choices, informative and fun comments, nifty sounds. I'm not sure what that means. continued. That might be the background noise.
I don't know. I would take that as a compliment for your choice of odd clips. Yes.
Yeah, I'm recording this in the attic, and there's been a seagull walking around just above me on the roof.
Oh, I've been able to hear it. Yes.
Yeah. Continued success, stay frosty, and all best wishes in all your efforts. If there's ever anything I can ever help with, please feel free, because I am an utter film geek with loads of stuff and too much time on my hands as a rule. Well, thank you, Uncle Bella. And yeah, if you've got film suggestions, season suggestions, or just comments on films that we've covered, or films you think we should cover that we haven't, because we are only doing 10 films in this season, and there's plenty more than 10 that we could have gone with. So,
oh yeah, and I should point out that for Fulci fans, later this summer, I'll be doing an episode on the Bloody Pit with my friend Troy and my friend Jeff. We're going to be talking about Conquest. So for Fulci fanatics, we'll be talking probably for far too long about Conquest later this summer.
Excellent. Yeah. We've got 2 films left, both from 1984, like this one that we've just done, A Man Called Rage and The Final Executioner, which are both films that currently I know very little about. So I'm going in cold on both of those. So that'll be fun. Following those two, we will do a quick sort of wrap-up episode where we rank the films And but that would be good if you've got any feedback for us on that episode about films you think we could have also included, and what, you know, but also just what you think of the films that we have done. Any feedback gratefully received. You can get in touch with us, wildwildpodcast@gmail.com, or on Twitter at @thewildwildpod, or on Instagram as well, which is also the wild, no, what are we called on Instagram? just wildwildpodcast. It's too much. It's too many places. But yeah, do let us know what you think we should be doing and all of that. It's good to hear from you. So we will be back again, probably realistically in about a month, because it's the summer now and there's stuff going on. But we will try and get this these next two episodes done fairly soon, because we're very keen to get into those jungle swamps and verdant forests to explore that particular.
Okay, so but your descriptors there honestly made me think that you were alluding to the private areas of a jungle girl who was nude. So,
Rod, it was bringing the tone down.
That is not true. But hey, I did want to say before we get out of here, take a good look at these contestants, because for these men, violent death is just seconds away.
yes. I mean, I would watch that show, so I, you know, just as bad as the rest of them. Just as bad as the rest of them. Okay, please remember to rate us on your podcast platform of choice, and subscribe, and tell your friends. How about writing Wild Wild Podcast on the side of walls with spray paint? Anything to get the word out there would be greatly appreciated.
Tag us so that people will wonder just what in the world we are.
Yeah, no, don't break any rules. We don't want that. Unless you live in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, in which case, feel free to spray as much as you like.
Yeah, if you've recently spotted Snake Plissken, then yes, you're free to do so.
Okay. Thank you, Rod, for being here again. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back soon. Have a great summer. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.